Members, we're going to get started. We're not quite at quorum yet. And but nonetheless, we have a lot. We actually have one bill today, but it's a, in the chair's opinion, an important bill and a substantive bill. And I wanted to make sure that the committee members had enough time to dig into it and have exchanges, interchanges with the with the author and the testifiers. Representative Beiner, I believe what we're going to do is lay this over for possible inclusion in the policy bill. Is that what we're doing?
Mr. Chair, that may be one of the options, but would it not need to move to K-12 finance?
Eventually it will,
okay.
But you know, we could certainly, you know, we'll have an hour and a half here to figure that out, and we'll
right.
communicate back and forth with you.
All right. Well, I'll let you make that call.
Okay. Well, it is your bill, so we want to make sure it's your call. So, but yeah, let's figure that out before we're done. So for now, just have the bill before us. Representative Breiner moves that House File 1441 be recommended to pass, so we'll be adjusting that motion later on, no doubt. So, Representative Breiner, we're in your hands.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And before I actually address the bill, I would be remiss if I didn't start by wishing the top of the morning to you. You may not be Irish, but it is St. Paddy's Day. And no, Breiner, it's not an Irish name, but I'm a Kathleen among a Mary, Michael, Timothy, Patrick, and John. So you can see that my mother has Irish blood.
You have all the bases covered.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Murdoch would like
to be recognized.
The proper response is the rest of the
day to you. Happy St. Patrick's Day to all of you.
Yes. Okay. In addition to that, today's the birthday of our youngest daughter. She's 22.
Congratulations.
So, you know, so it's a special day in our household, and I hope the luck of the Irish will be with me this morning. So with that, I'll move to the bill. Most of you are already aware of the broad outlines of this bill. Many of the testifiers we heard early in the session, Michelle Walker from St. Paul Public Schools, Sal Cocker from Edina, Rick Spacusa from South Washington County Schools, Mike Cohen from Achieve, and Commissioner Segrin and others have addressed one or more aspects of the issues involved in this bill. The general context of the bill is to move to a broader picture, broader than a single AYP measure, of how our schools are doing and how we might help them move forward in supporting student achievement. We ask this question: in reporting to parents and the public on the success of our schools, what indicators would you suggest and what tools would you recommend to monitor progress? The three measures put forward in this bill are the result of hundreds of hours of testimony, research, and input from a broad range of experts and stakeholders. With that introduction, I do have a delete all amendment. Representative Abler isn't here now, but I'm saying this specifically because on his behalf. It's the result of further work with MDE and other stakeholders. But while some of the changes revolve around substantive details, the bill is still substantially the same. The amendment could have been done separately, but was done as a delete-all to provide for an easier presentation and less confusion in tracking the bill. So before moving to the amendment, there are three small technical changes that Ms. Larson picked up in a review. And Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if we might ask Ms. Larson to note those changes orally.
Representative Breiner, I'm told we can't move the amendment yet because we don't have a quorum, but it's appropriate to go through those technical changes and the amendment as well. So you'd like Ms. Larson to talk about the technical changes then?
To note those? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members, on the document H1441DE3, there are three technical changes. On page 5, line 14, delete 3 and insert 4 so that it reads subdivision 4. On page 11, line 5, delete 20 and insert 30 so that it reads June 30th. And lastly, on page 12, line 22, the head note That subdivision addresses various kinds of data. So after progress in the headnote, insert and other. So that the headnote reads adequate yearly progress and other data.
So Representative Briner, excuse me, when we're at quorum, we'll move the amendment, and at that point we'll re-alert the members and we'll incorporate those changes in your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with that, I'll begin with a brief walkthrough of the D3 amendment. The first section is definitions on page 1. The few remaining differences we may have with the department are in this section. We have made changes to the third and fourth definition. The fourth definition, adequate yearly progress, we simply added or other approved adjustments for performance. And this was a clarifying recommendation from the department, not a substantive change.
Representative Breiter, and I hate to interrupt, but we are at quorum. So why don't we formally move your bill to, in fact, have it before us. So Representative Breiter moves House File 1441 be recommended to pass. And as I said, members will probably change that motion before the end of the, excuse me, of the hearing. So the bill is before us, and Representative Reinert would move the DE3 amendment. And for members just arriving, there are technical changes to that, small ones that you want to incorporate into that motion. On page 5, line 14, strike the word or the number 3, insert 4 after the word subdivision. Then on page 11, on line 5, strike the date 20 and insert 30. And then on page 12, line 22, the subheading on subdivision 2 after the word data, I think, is it data or after progress? After the word progress, insert and other. And so Representative Breiter would incorporate that into her D3 delete all. Amendment. So members, this puts the bill in the shape that Representative Reinert will be presenting it to us today. Excuse me, I'm sorry for my froggy voice this morning. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The D3 delete all amendments before it. Representative Reinert, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're discussing the definitions on page 1, and I noted the small change in the definition of adequate yearly progress. And I'll say the first three definitions are still under discussion. The differences between our proposal and the department's are very modest in actual language, but important in concept. And if I needed to summarize the difference, I would say the main question is whether the growth model is itself a value-added model. And we can come back to that in discussion. I don't believe it's a make-or-break issue in terms of the proposal itself, but it's something significant for the position of the growth model. So the remaining definitions are agreed to. And then Section 2, which is on page 2, statewide testing and reporting system, the new language you see here is departmental language from last year's omnibus bill, and we simply left it there. I believe it occurs elsewhere in the department's bill for this year. Other changes in this section are technical, with the exception of on page 5. On page 5, line 12 and 13, there's the reference to the value-added growth indicator, and that's the earlier discussion I referred to about whether this growth indicator could indeed be appropriately qualified as a value-added growth indicator. Then on line 525, we move from the word progress to proficiency, and that's an agreed-upon change in the context of No Child Left Behind, that proficiency is the measure of progress. Section 3, which is on page 6, system accountability and statistical adjustments. Again, on line 712, you have the reference to the value-added growth indicator. Otherwise, this section is a technical correction. Okay, Then Section 4 is really the heart of the matter as far as this bill is concerned. That's student academic achievement and growth. Subdivision 1 simply adds growth into the measures that are being considered. Subdivision 2 identifies the expectations for NCLB as federal expectations. We haven't done that in law before, and this bill does differentiate between federal and state expectations. One of the goals of the bill is to further develop our state system of accountability, but those aren't measures that come under NCLB, so we're defining them as state growth measures. So in subdivision 3, we note here, it says state growth targets, other state measures on line 19. And then within subdivision 3, the measures that we are proposing are identified. On paragraph B, line 921, we identify the implementation of the growth model. Last year in the bill, it was the identification of the growth model. A lot has occurred between now and then in terms of shaping and developing this model. And as with all language that refers to growth in this bill, it is intended to reflect the model that is currently being employed by the Department of Education. So on line 931 and 32, there's a reference to other value-added measures, and you'll actually see later this small sentence replaces the language that is repealed on value-added measures. It says the commissioner may recommend other value-added measures under Section 120B. And we can again discuss that further, but it's meant to leave the conversation open on how we will proceed on the value-added components. And then, let's see, line 934-35 retains the protection of individual teacher data that was contained in the repealer. That line is exactly as it was in the repealer language. Paragraph C on page 10, line 10-7, puts in place two course completion measures as evidence of post-secondary readiness, including core academic subjects and rigorous coursework. Current information simply covers course offerings, and we're moving toward actually measuring the completion of these courses. Paragraph B on line 1029 identifies our third measure, school safety and students' engagement and connection at school. This section identifies a process for determining what highly reliable variables will be used to gather this data. And subdivision 4 on page 11 requires the commissioner to report what we learned from medium and high growth schools. Obviously, we want both the legislature and the public to have some understanding of what the growth model is telling us about how our schools are performing. Then section 5 on page 11, school accountability and appeals process, enumerates what will be reported on the school performance report card. Section 6 is implementing rigorous coursework measures and simply puts in place a predictive model to give context to the course completion measures. And section 7 is similarly in relating to assessing school safety and students' engagement, gives further details of how the identification and reporting of these variables will occur. And then section 8 is the repealer I mentioned earlier, and the appendix isn't on the DE2 amendment, but if you look on your original bill, the last page, you'll see the actual language that is being repealed on the value-added assessment program. Paragraph A of that language is unnecessary given the current growth model. Paragraph B is replaced by the language I mentioned earlier on page 9. And paragraph C is unnecessary because the contractual provision is removed. So that's the walkthrough. And now we have three experts in each of the areas of the proposed measures that we're introducing in this bill. Excuse me, and I'd like to begin by introducing Dr. Heistad. Is that the role of the chair to invite Dr. Heistad to testify and identify himself? And Dr. Heistad does have a timeline today, so he'll present first and allow a small amount of time for questions, and then we'll move to our other testifiers.
Because Ryan's attorney, he's all the help he's necessary for him for vocalizing, so it's quite all right. We do have a question before we proceed with Dr. Heister from Representative Norton.
I can wait until after.
Okay, very well. Good morning, Dr. Heister. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Chair Mariana and representatives. I have a little frog in my throat this morning also. My name is David Heistead. I'm Executive Director of Research Evaluation Assessment for Minneapolis Public Schools. And I would like this morning just to give a brief overview of what the growth model looks like right now and how we're using it in Minneapolis. And districts throughout the state are using these data right now to inform their practice to find out the strengths and the weaknesses within their programs. And we're all quite pleased that we have these data available for such purposes. The way to locate the data are either to go to the state website or to type in this particular web link. Don't be fooled by the fact that the web link still says report card 2005. It's actually 2007, 2008 growth data. The data that are available are on all students who were in the school or in the district. If you look at school level, it'll be students that were enrolled for the whole academic school year from 2007 to 2008. If you look at the district level, data, those students are continuously enrolled in the district. And all these students were tested in 2007 and 2008. So it's actually representing the same students across time. And it eliminates some of the problems of AYP calculations that have different students in time one and time two. The first table that you would see when you go to a particular school or district looks just like this. On the left-hand side, it indicates whether students were proficient on the 2007 test or not proficient. And so you can see whether students who are proficient already made low, medium, or high growth, and whether students who are not yet proficient as of 2007 made low, medium, or high growth. This happens to be a district close to my heart, and I know that they're striving very hard to make sure that the students who are not yet proficient are making similar growth to this or greater growth than the students who are already proficient. What happens in the state and in most districts is the students who are already proficient are making the most growth, too, and the gaps are getting bigger. In this case, when I graph this information, it looks like the growth is quite similar for the students in Minneapolis schools who are not proficient and those who were proficient already. So at least there's some parity here in terms of the amount of growth that's taking place. Up in the green would be students who make high growth, in the red would be medium growth, and low growth would be in the blue. Now, when I'm talking about this to folks in the district, I'll say this is roughly equivalent to if you're making about a year's growth in a year's period of time, you'd be in the red. If you're making greater than a year's growth, you'd be in the green. And if you're making less than a year's growth, you'd be in the blue. So you can interpret it. We want to get more students making greater than a year's growth, especially for the students who are not yet proficient. So as we look at these data again this year and the year after, we're going to want to see that green section grow, and especially for the students who are not yet proficient. The state's website also will allow you to compare your district versus the state average. And in this case, I see that although our growth for students is similar for medium growth, the percent making about a year's growth is similar, we actually have fewer students making high growth than the state as a whole. So we have a challenge for all students to get the percentage making high growth up to at least the state average. The website also breaks out all of these data for the nine subgroups. So then we can get in and see how are we doing with students who are in poverty? How are we doing with English language learners, African-American students? I just show you one graph here that shows the percentage of students making high growth for both the district and the state is lower for free and reduced lunch students. So the students in poverty who tend to score lower on the test already are making less growth. So we see that in the state and in the district, the gaps are getting wider for the students in poverty. And in Minneapolis, we're making less growth in the state. So we have 25% of our free and reduced price lunch students making high growth versus the state. So it's a big challenge to us to get that percentage of students making high growth up for the students in poverty. And if I showed you all the graphs for African-American and Hispanic, American Indian, you would see the same thing. We have a big challenge to try to get the students who are scoring low, who are making less growth, really to catch up as fast as possible. We also have on the website a breakup by grade level. So you can look at your grade level teams and see, well, in this school, fifth grade is really making exceptional growth, but seventh grade is a challenge. And so when we go out to the buildings now, we share these growth data, we look at strengths and weaknesses, we look at which subgroups and which grade levels are making tremendous progress, and of course you have these data by math and reading. So it really becomes a diagnostic for the district. Right now we're setting budgets, we're revising school information reports and plans, and this is a very valuable tool. So I just want to acknowledge that we have a lot of information available now for evaluating the progress of our schools and our districts that we didn't have before. And then briefly, I'd like to mention a couple of future considerations. Currently, as I mentioned, these data are broken out by grade level. And I think that's an excellent unit of analysis for sitting with grade level teams and working with them on strengths and weaknesses. And there's a debate about whether this kind of growth model or a different kind of value-added model should be brought down to the classroom level. And my opinion, based on some research that I've done in Minneapolis and reading the national research, is that moving to the classroom level could be fraught with peril. And there are three reasons why I don't advocate at this present time moving to the classroom level. First of all, it's not just one teacher usually that's involved in the instruction. Many times you can have three or four different teachers, special ed, Title I teacher, ELL teacher. You might have volunteers from the AmeriCorps program or other volunteers coming in. And to actually keep track of all the various instructors that could be responsible for the growth for a particular classroom is very complex. And so that's the first consideration. The second one is that it really encourages competition among teachers rather than cooperation. And so if, for example, you had very large bonuses based on individual teacher level growth or value added, I think it could be counterproductive in that the teachers that really need the most assistance may not get assistance from their colleagues if this is a competitive situation. And finally, when you look at an individual teacher or classroom level, with the mobility in some school districts, Minneapolis especially, you have very few students that are continuously enrolled from through the whole year and have a test, pre-test and a post-test. So the reliability of the growth score can be very low. And so for those three reasons, I and my colleagues in the Minnesota Assessment Group, I think pretty unanimously, are not in favor of going down to the classroom level. I think most, feel strongly that we have excellent information at the grade level, and that we're using that for the benefit of students, and we're not sure that the cost benefit is on the side of getting down to the teacher level. I'd be glad to take brief questions.
Wonderful. Representative Reiner.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Heitzke. Just to comment on this issue, while I think it's an important issue to raise and certainly some discussion time could be devoted to it, it's not critical to the bill. It's more for the future. We do create room in the bill for value-added proposals to be brought back to the legislature as models are further refined, and then to look at the research and see what the research says. So this is more of a kind of a heads up to the group about the importance of the issue for the future, pay attention to research, but it, as I said, it doesn't, the decision on that doesn't derail anything essential to this proposal.
Mr. Biner, you read my mind, and I suspect this committee at times would want to go down the avenue of talking about what would be a fair, effective tool relative to individual teacher instruction, but we are mindful of your advice that the purpose here is not that, but nonetheless, you're not derailing that inevitable, perhaps, further exploration of other potential tools. Representative Norton, would you care to weigh in, or do you want to wait?
I'll wait for the other.
Very well. Any other questions or observations for Dr. Heiste? Dr. Heiste will need to be leaving early. I want to make sure that we have a chance to engage with him. Dr. Heiste, you said something at the very beginning of your presentation that caught my eye, and it's not to the core of the bill, but nonetheless, it was intriguing. I think what you said is statewide, students who are already proficient are showing much growth, and that is also a contributor to some of the gaps that we face. And I think we often think of gaps as solely being a product of proficiency levels for students who are not at proficiency, but I think this model shows us that there are a number of complicating realities here relative, because it's all relative, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, gap is, you know, mm-hmm. relative to one group to the other. And so I guess, in a way, one of the good news, if you will, sort of the double-edged sword, if you will, one of the good news our state is that those students who are showing proficiency in our schools are currently also showing a good clip of growth. Am I interpreting or hearing what you said?
Chairman Mariani, the growth is very solid for students who are already proficient, and in many cases, I've looked at a number of districts and schools in the state, it's the white students and middle class students that are making the most growth, and we've known all along that there is this huge gap in terms of proficiency, but here we can see very clearly that the growth rates also have a gap, so you can see why the gaps are getting larger. Now, that's not true in every district, and one of the instructive things about this model will be to get into those districts that are showing great growth for students in poverty and students of color and find out what it is that they're doing that's really narrowing the gap. But this really does focus very clearly on a problem that we have. And it's nice that the kids that are proficient are making such growth. It's just that the children that need to make the most growth aren't making as much as they need to get up to the standards.
Very well. Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I feel like I'm missing something here. When you describe proficient and non-proficient to begin with, what is the criteria that you're using to label a child non-proficient or proficient?
This is based on the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments in 2007, and then the growth is from 2007 to 2008. So on the table, the children who are labeled proficient were proficient in 2007. And so they scored, if they were in third grade, they scored 350 or higher on the third grade test. So they already started out above proficient, and they tend to make higher growth than the students who start out below 350 who are not proficient in general. But many districts are beating the odds, and it will be very interesting to find out what they're doing.
So I see where I've got a disconnect here. So then is this isn't on all students in the whole district. This is just third graders.
Chart is for all students, as it's labeled at the top, but I can also look at third graders separately. So the proficient on the state test would be 350 score for third grade, 450 for fourth grade, 550 for fifth grade. And so we can look at all of those grade levels combined. So the first level is to look at the whole school, and then you can drill down to particular grade levels or particular subgroups as you're interested.
Okay, Mr. Hesse, I guess what thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't realize that they take the MCAs at every grade level.
Yeah, so they take the grade level from, they take the test in grades 3 through 8, and then there's a 10th grade reading test and an 11th grade math test. So we skipped 9th grade.
Thank you.
Representative Obermueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Reiner?
What? Mr. Chair, I was just concerned to raise a question for Dr. Heistad before he left, but if Representative Obermueller has one for Dr. Heistad, I would go ahead.
Well, those might even be the same question. Representative Obermueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine is just making sure I understand the charts being provided to us. The chart that has proficient and non-proficient that Representative Dietrich was just asking about, that's showing students who actually made some growth. There would be a number, for example, in the proficiency, there'd be 51% of the students who made no growth. Is that correct?
There's high growth, medium growth, and low growth. And so for the students who make, who are proficient already, 14% of those students, it's 14% of the total. But, yeah, there are a large percentage that make either medium or high growth, and a much smaller percentage who make low growth. You're correct.
Mr. Chair, Representative Obermueller, I think I get the gist of your question, and that the total number is 100%. There are no students unrepresented on this chart. Proficient and non-proficient, low, medium, and high growth add up to 100%.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I am fascinated, Representative Ryder, by the 15% of, particularly the 15% of students who are proficient that are showing low growth. That's an interesting, I don't think it's how we typically tend to think of students who are at proficiency levels.
And Mr. Chair, that was one of the discussions prior to this model being developed of importance, is that simply with the AYP model, the cutoff is our focus, and then we don't differentiate above that what the needs of those students who are already proficient might be. And indeed, those students who are achieving low growth but are above that cutoff need particular attention, but we haven't been targeting those students in the past, and we will be now with this kind of data.
So, Representative Reiner, without casting aspersions on AYP methodology, one can say that this is a additional tool. Mm-hmm. AYP allows us to do certain things,
right,
and identify certain characteristics and outcomes. This allows us to continue to build on that and identify, perhaps in a more teased out way, further characteristics and outcomes that have everything to do with what we want to do in our schools and how we want to perhaps tailor our approaches with all students up and down the continuum.
Exactly, Mr. Chair, and that's why we've often called this model complementary to the AYP data, because it's a fuller picture.
Sure.
Now, just briefly, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Dr. Heistad before he needs to go, would you just comment on the value-added characteristics of this growth model, why it can be considered appropriately a value-added model?
Dr. Heistad, and perhaps along with that, I suppose that'll be part of the answer, particularly for our newer members and the chair who often forgets things, if you can just sort of and I know it won't be that easy, but tell us, you know, what is value added?
Mm-hmm. Chairperson Mariani and Representative Reiner, the definition of value added that was proposed last year and is in the bill right now is the most general definition of value-added, that it's really different from a baseline. Now, that would include the simplest model where there's only a pretest and a post-test, which is what we have in our growth model currently. But it also could include very complex models that have student characteristics in the model with control for English language learner, special ed status, gender, etc. Or it could control for school factors or community factors. There are almost as many models as there are statisticians. So the model that the definition that was proposed is the most general model. And so it does include just a pre-post test model, as well as very sophisticated. There's a model in Tennessee where they take all the information from all the tests that are given to make a prediction about a reading test, and it's over 6 or 7 years. Well, we couldn't do that model in Minneapolis, in Minnesota right now, because we only have 2 test data points. But as we get 3 or 4 or 5 data points, we could consider a more sophisticated model. At that point, the current definition would apply as well. If you start out with a definition that kind of assumes the complex model, you may not have the data in place to really be able to do that model to start with. So our preference was to put forward the simplest model possible, the most parsimonious definition.
Professor Breiner?
Thank you, Dr. Heidstedman. I think at this point we'd like to move to our second testifier.
Thank you. Dr. Heidstedman, thank you for being with us here today and for your work with this committee over the last couple of years in fleshing out these new policy approaches to assessment.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Representative Breiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our second proposed measure is course completion. And we have with us today Kent Pickell, whom you've heard under other circumstances, to testify to the importance of a course completion measure for post-secondary readiness.
Dr. Pickell, welcome. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The doctor's work in progress, Mr. Chair, but thanks for the promotion.
Doctor in anticipation.
Thank
Pickell.
You. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kent Pickell, and I'm Executive Director of the College Readiness Consortium at the University of Minnesota. I am honored to have this opportunity to say a few words this morning about why I support this bill in general and the provisions on advanced course taking in particular. I'm enthusiastic about the broader bill because it represents a strong step toward using multiple measures to make important educational decisions. Whether the choice at hand is granting a high school diploma to an individual student or evaluating the performance of an entire school, good policy and good practice require us to provide practitioners, parents, and policymakers with more than one measure of performance on which to base their decisions. That's true not only in education, but in other fields as well. When a cancer doctor decides on the type and amount of chemotherapy to give a patient, he or she considers blood cell counts, tumor markers, PET scans, CAT scans, x-rays, MRIs, a physical exam, the patient's weight, level of fatigue, and even mental state. When an airline pilot flies a plane, she or he looks at an instrument panel that includes an airspeed indicator, the attitude indicator, the altimeter, the heading indicator, the vertical velocity indicator, the transponder, the tachometer, the compass, of course, the ignition switch, and much more. With this legislation, we are proposing to add a limited number of valuable indicators to Minnesota's educational dashboard. The indicator that I have helped to conceptualize and am here to support is the number and percentage of students in a high school who take the rigorous courses required for college admission and success. I believe that dial has to be on that dashboard because taking such courses is closely associated with completing a college degree, which in turn is a strong predictor of success in today's global economy. As you'll see from the handout entitled High School Course Taking and College Completion, research has shown that students who take a rigorous college preparatory curriculum have a 95% chance of completing a college degree. The research to date doesn't prove that rigorous course taking causes college completion, but we can definitely say it contributes to it in important ways. The study I've highlighted on this sheet was conducted by Dr. Clifford Adelman, now of the Institute for Higher Education Policy in Washington, D.C. He analyzed longitudinal studies of students from high school through their college years and found that the academic intensity of the courses they took in high school counted more towards completing a college degree than either high school grades or test scores. It counted more than either high school grades or test scores, the rigor of the courses they took. While Adelman finds that taking rigorous courses in all subjects listed on the sheet is important, if you had to identify the most critical ones, the research suggests that it would be a combination of the highest level of math and the number of Carnegie units in core lab science. Unfortunately, as you will also notice on the sheet, according to a recent report from the National Center for Public Policy in Higher Education, the percentage of Minnesota students who take upper-level math and science classes is well below the median performance of the top five states, and we have not increased significantly since the early 1990s. That data, if it's correct, and it's gathered through a survey conducted biannually by the Council of Chief State School Officers, should give us all significant pause. While we can expect to see growth in those numbers in the years ahead as Minnesota's new high school graduation requirements kick in, we still have quite a ways to go. This is particularly true for students of color and low-income students in our state who are generally underrepresented in advanced courses when compared to their presence in the student population as a whole. That's a problem, but also an opportunity. If our goal is to close the gaps that exist in college completion among demographic groups in our state, Adelman's study confirms that getting more students of color to participate and succeed in rigorous high school courses is the single best thing we could do. Interestingly, his research finds that the benefits of such classes are particularly powerful for Latino students. Mr. Chairman, let me conclude by briefly noting that the inclusion of rigorous course-taking data on a new school report card needs to proceed in tandem with two related efforts in order to ensure that the measures are valid and reliable. First, it must be closely connected to the efforts that the Department of Education now has underway to create a common course catalog for our state. Absent such a common course identification system, course classification system, we would have no accurate way to know which courses should be included on the report card beyond externally validated courses such as advanced placement, international baccalaureate, and post-secondary enrollment options. For example, a school's English 12 honors class might or might not be truly college preparatory. The answer depends on the content of the course rather than the name on the transcript. But that effort is underway and is proceeding at present. The second effort that should be completed in tandem with including course-taking information on the new report card is the creation of a longitudinal data system that can seamlessly gather the information on an ongoing basis. That effort is also underway at the state level. With both of these critical supports in progress or in place, I believe that including high school course-taking data on the new state report card will encourage more high schools to offer more advanced classes to more students. And by helping to achieve that goal, the use of multiple measures will provide our students with multiple opportunities to prepare for college work and citizenship. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pickell. Questions? Representative Norton.
Thank you. This is where my question fits. It's more of a comment than a question. He actually, Mr. Pickell did a really nice job in talking about two of the concerns I've had, and Representative Briners and I have kind of talked about this for the last year or so. She's been working on this. My concern has been with the area of rigor, and I wanted to make sure that districts that don't offer APIB, either because they don't have the number of students to participate, they can't afford to buy the curriculum, which is, you know, costly, that they were not going to be negatively impacted somehow on a report card when it was published. Because currently we do not have a way to measure, because we don't follow students once they leave high school to find out if the curriculum that perhaps a small community is using or any school is using could produce students that do excel and are successful in their secondary programs even though they didn't have AP or IB. And so I've been concerned as we've moved along in this that we aren't tracking those post-secondary students and that there isn't a definitive way to say, you know, Hayfield, Minnesota didn't have APIB perhaps, but they had a rigorous curriculum and 70% of their kids that went on to college were successful and got four-year degrees, and therefore their district has a rigorous curriculum. And that's what I've been getting at, and I really appreciated your comments that while we're not there yet, we are recognizing that and moving toward at least some way to measure in the future. So it was going to be a question, and instead it's pontificating, and I apologize.
Mr. Pacal, you can pontificate as well.
Mr. Chair, I'll add a brief note of pontification. I would agree that this is a very, very important effort, because you don't want to water down the rigor, because then we defeat the purpose, and we don't want to actually put kids into courses that don't actually meet their needs. An example that I would add to your list is technical education. We know we have, to a great extent, gotten out of the business of what used to be called vo-tech in the 70s, and we need to get back into it. We need to have rigorous technical education that really is post-secondary preparation. That doesn't look like AP or IB, but it is the kind of course taking. There are ways to make sure that technical education is academically rigorous. There are various national certification programs, and I think that this bill would include that type of course taking as it is validated by sound measures of rigor. So we want to be really careful that we don't create sort of perverse incentives to put kids into challenging classes that aren't what they need.
And if I could follow up, the other concern I have, and again, because we're talking about AP, IB, or technical programs, I don't want to push a district to have to spend dollars on a program that they need to buy if there are other ways to produce rigor in the classroom. And so I just want to, if districts are struggling all around the state right now financially, and we're going to be unable to support them in a significant way perhaps for some time into the future, I just don't want to push them into a situation where we're going to measure them as not being rigorous because they can't spend the money to buy a program.
Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norton, this is an ongoing discussion, and I really appreciated your input in this area. But I would say that if you look at Section 6, which aims to implement a predictive model, so that when you're looking at schools like Hayfield, or outstate schools, that she started picking on Hayfield, so sorry about that, Representative Demmer.
I think we got Representative Demmer's attention.
It worked for me.
Yeah.
But my point is that you would be looking at schools with similar, not only similar demographics, but similar course taking opportunities. And the first measure that we're looking at, which is simply not the rigorous course piece, but course preparation, that will be advanced by the Common Course Catalog work that the department is doing, and will allow us to look at exactly those kinds of schools and what they're offering, and to see, track their success rate. So we will be doing exactly, I think, what you were challenging us to do.
Wonderful. Anyone else? Oh, Representative Bloom, yes.
Right, thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for coming a few minutes late this morning. It's a very important topic. With regard to the rigor, of course, I'm very interested in your comments, Mr. Peckle, on this, and I'm wondering if you could comment at all on what you're seeing in terms of what's happening at schools. I've got a high school daughter, and so I'd like to relate my personal experience. It helps me kind of bring this down to the parent understanding what's happening with their own child's education. But to the degree that issues of class rank and that, and that's been a debate, I think, at our own school, you can pray that they're looking at getting rid of class rank, and the extreme focus of children and presumably perhaps parents on grades as to what impact that may have in terms of the rigor of the courses that children are taking. And also, are you referring to embedding more rigor into sort of the basic level courses across post-secondary education and the high school education, or are about advanced placement classes? Because I know in a lot of schools, and starting even in the fourth and fifth grade levels, as they're developing different stratifications of math and other courses according to children's ability, a lot of times a kid will get on a certain track, and then they're not allowed to take a more rigorous course unless they get a certain grade or a certain test score. And that really prohibits kids who perhaps don't test well but are extremely motivated and hardworking students from being able to access some of that more rigorous course material, especially in their earlier, perhaps up through 10th grade level.
Terrific question, Mr. Patel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is a terrific question. To take class rank first,
This is a minefield, and it's one that I stepped in during my time as an administrator in St. Paul Public Schools, where we actually proposed getting rid of class rank and moving to something that looks like what universities do, which is bands. So you have summa cum laude, magna cum laude at a university. We propose with honors. The rationale being there really is no statistical difference between number 8 and number 9, and number 9 may have taken a much more demanding program than number 8. The class rank debate takes you into another big debate of weighted course grades. Should you give a kid extra credit for doing these kinds of things? I would suggest that for the purposes of state policy, you all have enough fish to fry, and those are battles that are going to be fought at the local level. I will say that a serious focus on college readiness does help to resolve those battles. In this way, most colleges unweight the grades, and fewer colleges take class rank seriously because there's no common way to really validate the rigor of high school A to high school B. And so these measures that parents in particular get obsessively concerned about, the more we say, you know what, the University of Minnesota or Carleton or St. Cloud, don't look at that the same way you think they do. We may be able to shift what can be a very, very complex and difficult debate on some of those issues. We do need to consider them, though, and we need to consider them thoughtfully because they are a very big deal for kids and for families and for some teachers who get very invested in that issue. So that's a mushy way of agreeing that it's an important issue that I don't think there's one fix for. It's a local-level discussion that I think state policy and research can inform. In terms of the larger issue you raise about rigor, I would agree completely. The goal really here is to raise the bar across the board. The goal is to be sure that all students are increasingly challenged. And what we've learned is that remediation doesn't work, acceleration does. That kids respond to the high expectations and the opportunity to stretch. That pull out doesn't work, and louder, faster, harder doesn't work, but different instruction does. So this is about kids at what, for lack of a better way to put it, we're talking about the bottom of the distribution. But to the point that you raised about access to the most rigorous courses, so you need to raise the bar across the board, but here's what you really need to do. You need to not have, especially our secondary schools, which were largely created at the turn of the last century to sort kids into food groups. And they were designed to have about 30% of our kids go on to college, and even in the last three decades, about 30%, 28 to 29% in a given year of Americans have earned college degrees. Our high schools produce what they were designed to produce in the industrial age. And they were sorting mechanisms. They sorted kids, and you were on the path, and that was your destiny. I think that the paradigm shift that you suggest you're seeing in your daughter's school is this. It's not that every kid needs to be in those AP or IB classes, but they do need to have access to them. And I'll just give you one brief example of that. South High School in Minneapolis, one of the programs we run with state support is a program called the Minnesota Principals Academy. It's a year-long executive development program for school principals that I hope you will continue to support. The principal at South High School finished that program, Dr. Linda Nelson, who's just announced she's retiring, great educator. She came out and she said, I can no longer run a large urban high school with all of these prerequisites to get into our advanced courses. She said, from now on, the price of entry is the kid and the parent wants to put forth the effort. And it's the first year they've done it, and you know what? The sky has not fallen. They did away with the gatekeeper requirements that you had to have this GPA, you had to have these many other hoops jumped through, and they said the price of entry is effort. Now, some kids aren't going to succeed, and you need to make a decision then to say we need to find a better place for you. But I would say the degree to which we still have got to turn the battleship on that issue, especially in our junior highs, boy, that seventh grade math placement is a big deal. And a lot of parents don't realize that when they choose that math class for their seventh grader, they're making a big decision about their future, unless we get a system that allows more movement among these levels.
Thank you. We could spend a lot of time on that question. A wonderful question. Also, great advice. And I know that some of our friends who are here daily watching our committee from our local school districts love the advice. So, you know, there's some of this room where you just need to allow local level decisions and trust that and really think about state policy, not as being overly prescriptive, but providing the room for which that to happen. Representative Reiner.
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment. Mr. Pickell pointed to seventh grade, and I'll just say several years ago, Mankato Public Schools actually opened their accelerated math program to children on the basis of choice, not qualification. Parents who were willing to work with their kids and put forth the effort were allowed in, and it was just for the reasons that Mr. Pickell has described, and it quite changed the program quite dramatically.
Professor Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How important, you know, when we're discussing parents getting the right classes or getting at least information about the right classes for their children and working with their children, how important do you think the role of a counselor, I sound like Representative Tilbury now, but how important is the role of a counselor in all of that?
Mr. Pickell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, it's critical. But it can't. We can't leave it just to the counselor. You know that the reality. I was a high school teacher, and this college readiness was the job the counselors did, and I taught social studies. We have to change that paradigm, whereby the counselor is the critical hub of the wheel in the school of providing this information. But everybody in the school considers college readiness and course taking decisions their business. If you go to an elite private school, St. Paul Academy up the street from me. They don't leave course-taking decisions just to the counselors. It's something. But those counselors have an indispensable role. You know the ratios that we're at in Minnesota in terms of counselors. I was making a presentation to the School Board Association several months ago, and there was a board member from Greater Minnesota, and I appreciated the question. He said, are you telling me if you had to cut budgets, you'd prioritize counselors over classroom teachers? And I said, yes. If college readiness is your goal, yes. Now, I hope you don't have to prioritize one over the other, because that's choosing an arm over one arm over the other. But if you have to, it is an indispensable role. The reality is our high schools are still largely significantly driven by choice. And so making those course decisions, as we have been talking about, is a very high stakes decision, and counselors have a really indispensable role in making sure parents and kids understand where they need to get. The research really suggests, just one point to reinforce your point, when kids are asked what's the hardest part of getting ready for college, they universally say the hardest part is getting in. And once you're in, you got it made. In fact, what we know from our 25% completion rate of people, you know, in the society who earn a college degree, the hardest part isn't getting in, it's getting through. And getting the message to the kids and the families that, in fact, every step you take beyond Algebra 2 in the high school math curricula doubles your chance of earning a BA. That it's not just the entrance requirements, it's the knowledge and skills to complete. That's a critical message, and counselors are very well placed to be the people who deliver it to kids and families.
Representative Brenner, I want to do a time check. I know you have another person, Dr. Jenny Norland Weaver, will be testifying, and we also want to have room for others. Do you have other testifiers besides Dr. Norland Weaver?
No, I don't, but Mr. Chair, I would appreciate it if we could take Dr. Weaver's testimony, and then if Mr. Pickell can remain around, we can have more opportunity for discussion, but I'm concerned that we give fair time to the three measures.
I agree. We do have two questions from Representative Demmer and Cass. Would you be willing to wait, or would you want to jump in at this point? To this point, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, it's more of a comment, and it'll be very quick. Regarding Mr. Pickell's comments about the counselors, well, that's more important than some other piece. I would submit an agreement with you that really it's all aspects. And I'll put a little plug in for our informational hearing coming up, Mr. Chair, if you will, on Friday morning, and also the hearing on Thursday regarding quality improvement, the Baldrige criteria, where you talk about all the arrows pointing together and everybody striving toward common goals and not putting extra emphasis maybe in one part or another, but everybody striving for a similar type of thing. And I think that's what I heard you kind of saying, is that we're not saying counselors aren't important, teachers aren't important. We're saying everybody has to be striving towards similar goals and that sort of thing. So just a quick plug for that, Mr. Chair, as we talk about quality in our schools and what that means. So I thought I'd better throw that in there.
Thank you. Representative Kapp? Wonderful. So you'll be around, Dr. Sabi, Pickell, and Dr. Jenny Norland Weaver.
So, Mr. Chair, members, our third measure is summary data on school safety and students' engagement and connection at school, and Dr. Weaver is here to speak to that measure.
Dr. Norland Weaver, welcome.
Thank you, Representative Breinert. Thank you, Chair Mariani. My name is Jenny Norlin Weaver, and I work as the Director of Teaching and Learning for the Edina Schools. And I'm here partly because I've been in an advisory capacity to the group that's been working on these measures over the last couple of years. Engagement is a measure we're going to talk about just for a bit this morning. It's a measure that we use in Edina. One of the ways we do that is through gathering information from our children, not just in terms of some of the measures that are required of us under No Child Left Behind and other data collection sort of methodologies, but also because we've entered into partnership with other similarly high-performing school districts across the country. And one of the ways that we noted that we could compare our progress against each other was in looking at engagement measures. So we've utilized that measure in our school district over a long period of time. One of the things that's near and dear to my heart is this whole notion that we can further develop our accountability system in Minnesota so it embodies more than just the output measure that we get when we look at a test score. So the MCAs have done a nice job in the proposal to look at the growth and value-added kinds of situations will assist us in getting better information in that regard. When I first came before this body some 12 years ago, I was working at the University of Minnesota, and we were working on recommendations for the initial endorsement of accountability for Minnesota schools and Minnesota school systems. And at that time, we really thought about those measures falling across three categories. We thought about what do we know about students from an input standpoint? In other words, what do they bring to us? And as we talked about poverty and we've talked about mobility, we recognize that those are some indicators that we need to continue to attend to and to think about in terms of how we might accommodate for those measures as students hit our schools. We also have spent a great deal of time in Minnesota. As a matter of fact, I'd suggest the majority of our time looking at these output measures. What do students look like at the end of the trail? But I think we've spent less time with our process indicators. So if you think about what happens when students get to school and the kinds of things that we can sometimes impact that go beyond the preparation for a content assessment, these are measures that I think we'd also want to look at in Minnesota as we think long and hard about what we're doing. So what I've prepared for you this morning is a bit of information about engagement, and I'd like to share some of that with you. Students who are engaged in their work are energized by four goals: success, curiosity, originality, and satisfying relationships. So when you start to think about those three R's we sometimes hear about in the high school reform, you can see the alignment. Engagement's been used to depict students' willingness to participate in school activities that contributed to their success, such as taking and attending rigorous classes, certainly aligns with the testimony you just heard, submitting required work, and following teachers' directions in class. As early as 1984, we defined student engagement as participating in the activities offered as part of the school program. Last week, I saw some fascinating information in the light of the kinds of budget cuts that we're talking about. As an example, there's data collection that's been done on the eastern part of our country that suggests that there's actually a tipping point when you look at the number of activities students are engaged in outside of school. So not just what happens within the school boundaries, but also when we talk about our extracurriculars and the kinds of things students are doing outside of our walls. And what's really fascinating is there's an actual alignment they could find between students who got up to four activities, if you will. When students reached four activities, you saw at a high point, a tipping point in their GPA that was a B+ or better. Once they began to get into more activities than that, and this is not a surprise to you who are parents, we actually began to see a decline in the GPA. So then there was an interesting sort of conversation about how do you counsel or encourage students to be engaged in certain kinds of things, but to pick carefully. 10 years later, in 1994, we've noted that students who are engaged exhibit three characteristics. They are attracted to their work. There is no teacher I know who wouldn't like students to come to school and be attracted to their work. They persist in their work despite challenges and obstacles, and they take visible delight in accomplishing that work. By 2004, so you can see we've had some migration of this conversation over time, research in Minnesota at the University of Minnesota on the Check and Connect program has found that addressing student engagement early correlates with truancy prevention,
diminished dropout rates, and increased persistence. One of our colleagues, Dr. Sandra Christensen, has done a lot of work in this area, and one of the things that the Check and Connect program has found is that you can actually diminish dropout rates and at the same time increase engagement, therefore students who are not only ready to finish high school but to go on. And that particular program has been highlighted by the federal government as one of the What Works programs. Why would we report on student engagement as one of the multiple measures? It's because it's relevant for all students. It's something that we can look at across time. It's correlated with positive academic and behavioral learning outcomes. Engaged students across grade levels tend to earn higher grades, perform better on tests, report a sense of belonging, set or respond to personal goals, and persist on meaningful tasks. They make a personal investment in their learning, and they show signs of self-regulated learning. In the Edina schools, one of the things that we're invested in and engaged in right now is we're trying to define what we believe personalized learning might be. What does it mean to personalize learning for our students? And I believe that one of the very best potential possibilities that we have in doing that is to reach a point where students become better self-advocates for learning. Engagement measures are one of the ways that we can support that. It's a mediator of positive learning outcomes for those students who get off track. So in other words, when we start to notice that a student is moving away from the pathway of success, we can take a look at those indicators and determine how we might mediate them. It's also a critical variable for identification and intervention design for high school graduation. It can be measured earlier than high school, so there are early warning signs for students that we begin to look at. It explicitly addresses motivation to learn. It emphasizes student responsibility for learning and is linked to enrolling in academic coursework as a critical habit of the mind. In other words, the students engaged in wanting to take that coursework. So these students that we begin to open the doors for and say, really the pathway to success is your willingness, your engagement, your wish, your desire to take these rigorous courses is all that's required. I think most importantly, it's about student learning. It's not just about taking a test and achieving on that test at one particular point in time. It begins to tap into those 21st century skills that we know are important, the deeper understanding and the meaning. It is also an alterable variable. One of the things to recognize is that in the bill, I'm very pleased that we've taken a tack that suggests that we need some time to develop this well. That an extended timeline where we're not beginning to report on this particular measure until 2013. And that's because we want to find the time to get input on the content. In other words, which engagement measures and the efficiency that we can gain in measuring those indicators deserve some study by educators, not only administrators, but teachers and other stakeholder groups. Reporting at the school or district level is essential because we want to act on that information for school improvement planning. Right now, just this week, I've been going through the school improvement planning reports that our schools have been providing to me, and one of the things that we notice is that they're so focused on the reading and the math scores, and those are very good things to focus on, but we don't want to focus on those things to the detriment of other things. There are enough measures available to examine the items or factors to be selected for school reporting, so we're not looking at developing a whole new cumbersome system or a new survey. We do need to study available measures with those stakeholder groups so we ensure the student engagement indicators provide valid, clearly understood data and they focus efforts on student improvement. The other thing is to recognize that the current budget challenges are another reason that I think this timeline to take us to 2013 is important, so that we're not just kind of plopping another unfunded mandate into the process, but we're looking carefully and thoroughly at how these things can align with the work that we're engaged in. So if we think about engagement as one of the measures of student success, we can talk about things like, do students attend school? I know that sounds ironic, but if they're there, they tend to do better. At some point, before we had really great data systems available, I worked with my husband, who's a building principal in Minneapolis, who had a bit of curiosity about the eighth graders in his school who hadn't passed the BST. We spent a productive Sunday afternoon in his office, where we opened up lots of CUME folders. And no surprise to you and I, we found a very high percentage of students who hadn't passed the BST in eighth grade also didn't attend school very regularly. So we can look at some of the indicators that we have information on as measures of engagement, and I would encourage you to include those things and continue to support that work as it moves forward in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Norlin Weaver. We do have a couple questions, Representative Cass and Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine kind of goes back to Mr. Patel, but I think, Dr. Weaver, you could weigh in on this as well. And that is with PSEO students, and specifically how we see that, first of all, entering into the engagement process. When we're taking a student out of that building, if it's a PSEO option where they are concurrent enrollment. As well as, Mr. Patel, within your testimony of the course taking college completion, are there any indicators of somebody who is taking PSEO and their college completion? Because I don't see that on here. I note a lot about, you know, the advanced placement courses, IB, and things like that. But what do we know about PSEO?
Dr. Norlin Weaver.
Representative. What we know about PSEO is that it also engages students in the sense that children who make a decision to engage in PSEO classwork, course taking, are among those students who've made some decisions that are very productive and positive in terms of the work that they engage in. I'm back to thinking about counselors in part of my response. It is rather a rare student who learns about PSEO simply through osmosis. And so if you think about the work of counselors, it's those counselors who give the students that information and assist them in that course-taking behavior.
Mr. Patel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say the reason it's not on Adelman's list is that most states are nowhere close to Minnesota in both the length of time that kids have been able to take post-secondary classes and the number who do that. So the research, the hard research is really inconclusive. There are studies from Florida and South Carolina seem to suggest that when a kid takes a class on a college campus for college credit, it does have benefits in their going on to and succeeding in college, and that sort of makes sense logically, but it's really, really inconclusive. It hasn't been studied that much, and I suggest that it's actually not. You're raising a really important issue. I will tell you, as I'm around the state and the various work I do, and I want to be careful how I say this because I don't know what's the truth. I meet a lot of high school administrators and teachers who suggest that their kids are going to the local higher ed institution and taking coursework that's far less rigorous than they would take in the high school. It's for college credit, but it's less challenging than what they'd get in English 12, for instance. Now, you go to the higher ed institution and you'll find faculty who will disagree potentially with that. So we kind of have fingers pointing, but this is, as you know, a major state investment. And so the notion of taking a look at what kinds of post-secondary experiences really do promote college success, what because a kid really does go take it and it suddenly is outside the whole realm of state standards and assessments. And in some ways that's a benefit, but it also really kind of means we're flying blind in that exactly what really is the right experience. Back to the point about counselors, we keep singing the same hymn here. Whether it's counselors, teachers, or parents, one issue that does seem increasingly clear to me is that whether it's taking post-secondary options, classes, or AP or others, we do need to work with families and kids to make sure that it's a coherent program, that it's not a smorgasbord. I'll just try one from column A, one from column B, because we do know more and more that learning is like a snowball. Academic success is like a snowball, and you need to build. And so that if we actually have students not taking a program that builds, it has serious consequences for getting that student truly college ready by the end of high school. I don't think there's ever going to be a state curriculum or a single mandated way to do that. We need to help families understand what college readiness means and how you progressively move toward it. And when they consider having their kid take a class at a post-secondary institution, the question is this going to contribute to your student's post-high school plan?
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll say that I wholeheartedly agree, is the idea of that snowballing effect. And we have numerous within my school district of students who are leaving the school to take a PSEO option. And some of that that option is not building upon the rigorous coursework that we had built our program to support. And that is the idea that we have a very comprehensive program for advanced placement and IB options and things of that nature, and they're going out, and we are hearing that they're taking courses because it's a college course, that it must be more rigorous, but we are finding that in many instances it may not be as rigorous as what we're offering. And so that's a concern that I have, and I hope that as a committee we can start to examine that, because I think that's what's really important here is how does PSEO fit into this, as well as how does it fit into student engagement. When you're pulling that student out of that building, now you're taking out an engagement piece there that I think is so critical about looking at a whole picture about what is that school offering to that student and how is it providing for college readiness as well as preparation in the future.
Representative Peterson and McFarland, and then I do want to invite members in the audience to come and testify if they so desire, and then we'll pick up with questions from there. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was just looking at the language in both the bill and in the sheet, and the whole issue of student engagement is very complex. It involves certain accounts, as we talked about, parents, the students themselves, and I think it's like an onion. When you begin to peel away the layers, you certainly get to those external things that are looked at here, like student attendance and home support, etc. But you also then get down to the level of the school culture, and I would suggest that, and I don't see it on here, but I guess I would ask, how do you intend to address those issues like bullying and the things that go on in the class, in a school, that really engage or disengage students at a real gut level, a real personal level? And I don't know if you intend to do that with this kind of reporting, or if you're looking at more of the superficial kinds of pieces, the outcome, I would say, pieces more. Or are you going to get more to the real gut level of what goes on in the school?
I suspect there is actually a long answer to this, and appropriately so. But I do want, it's a very... And we know, Representative Peterson, you've got a bill on bullying, and I think so does Representative Dabney and a couple of other members. So let's have a quick response. We'll certainly circle back to this question.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, and Dr. Norlin Weaver may have something to say here, too. But I would say, first of all, it's not an issue of picking the superficial over the more complex or accurate measures. We're looking for the most accurate measures, but we're talking about measures now. These are indicators of student success. These aren't the policy solutions to get at the underlying problem. We are not addressing that. We're talking about indicators and measures. So certainly bullying could be a problem underlying the picture, but it's not what the measure is targeted at.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This really isn't a question, but I was wondering if the department could come down and address their involvement in this process, and also if they have any concerns or support and issues with this stuff.
That's wonderful. Let's get one more question. We'll then open up the floor for the department or anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify. Representative Downey.
I'll wait.
Okay, very well. Thank you. And just while the department comes down, I just wanted to... just make the observation, I suppose you're all also making, I think it was a part of Representative Katz's line of questioning, and that is that I think what Representative Reiner has laid before us is not one of three, but it's the interplay of these measures, and I think it's really important for us to wrap our minds around that. So I love the question that's been cast of PSEO participation as a college, you know, ready rigor standard, but also relative to the student engagement dynamics present in the schools. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Patricia Duffy Olson from the Department of Assistant Commissioner. We've been involved in meetings with Representative Reinert and some of the witnesses here, and we found the process to be very collegial. And we are continuing dialogue and look forward to continuing on the last few concerns we have. But in general, we think that the bill is supportable. And we look forward to putting the measures in place and continuing the improvement of the students in Minnesota.
Thank you, Commissioner Olson. And we certainly future date, look forward to hearing more about the department's work in regards to the Common Core Catalog. We did hear a little bit about that a few weeks ago, and also the longitudinal data system that would feed into this overall effort. Representative Downey, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is maybe a question for you, Representative Reinert. How realistic is it for schools in their current data collection capabilities to actually really put these new measures into effect? Is this realistic given where they're at?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downing, that's an excellent question. And I would say one of the things you need to look at in the bill is the timeline. We are allowing quite a bit of time for this development. And the other thing that we really haven't taken detailed testimony on, but you may have heard in other contexts, is the work the department has been engaged in. The department is actively involved in moving our data system statewide forward in a very aggressive manner. Now, they did have a federal grant, which some of the work of the Common Core Catalog was being done under, and they didn't receive the second round of that grant. But they, my understanding is they'll be applying for further federal support under the Federal Recovery Act dollars to continue to develop our data systems and have them, you know, work cross-platform in a more broad way. So the goal is to work these pieces together, and that's why we're in discussion with the department about the implementation dates, so that they're closely correlated and that school districts are able to gather this data in as efficient a way as possible.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then a follow-up. I'm wondering about the significance of the terminology on the headings, segregating the federal requirements from the state requirements. My assumption listening to this is that we're not really changing No Child Left Behind annual yearly progress. We're really kind of putting some leading indicators, some process measures in place, which I would agree with. But so what was the significance of segregating state versus federal in the bill?
Good question. Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Downing. I would say it's for clarification, partly because the AYP requirements are under No Child Left Behind, whereas the growth target and the other measures we're putting in place are state, as a part of the state accountability system. Again, not contending, but complementary measures meant to mutually support one another, but schools are responsible to the state for those measures, and the state is not responsible to the federal government for those measures.
And Representative Reinhardt, there's nothing under the federal requirements relative to NCLB that bars states from developing such a complementary accountability system. Very well. I believe we have one other person that wishes to testify, or at least that I've gotten a note. If that person come forward, if there's anyone else that wishes to testify, please come forward at this time. Dr. Efron, good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Karen Efron. I'm here on behalf of EdWatch bring up some issues for your consideration as you proceed with this bill. And I have a handout for you that relates to what I'd like to say.
We'll have a page handout.
We're talking a lot about measures and indicators, all with the hope of improving the achievement gap, which is a very admirable goal and which EdWatch agrees with. However, a lot of the things that you all are trying to do by these things have only a hope of improving adequate yearly progress and closing the achievement gap. We actually have things, as indicated by these studies, that we already know that work. And the one that I want to focus on particularly is number 3 on that sheet that you're getting, which is two-parent families and religious involvement. That doesn't just improve the achievement gap, it erases it. Black and Hispanic students, 20,000 that were studied under a national data set from the U.S. Department of Education found that if they had two parent families and religious involvement, they scored the same as white students on both reading, math, and as social studies as well. And then there are other studies listed there regarding phonics as opposed to whole language, and there's studies about parental involvement, and this is genuine parental involvement, not government school parental involvement programs. So these are the things that we think you should be focusing on, as opposed to developing complicated and expensive systems that do value added or that measure subjective and intrusive measures of student engagement and family involvement.
Dr. Ephraim, I am going to move you along because we do have one other person from the audience that wishes to testify. We have about 3 minutes left, so we can just quickly wrap up.
I will finish summarizing. My other concerns are what Representative Downey brought up about the federal piece. It appears to us that that is knuckling under to No Child Left Behind when there has been a strong history at both the Minnesota Congressional Delegation and bilaterally in this legislature of opposing No Child Left Behind because of its 10th Amendment concerns. And there's also the legislative auditor's study that shows that that 80 to 100% of Minnesota schools are going to fail to make AYP by 2013.
Thank you.
And then student engagement is just intrusive, and there's no real governmental authority or need to collect all that data.
Thank you, Dr. Ephraim. Representative Brainerd, I understood you asked for a fiscal note on this that has not been generated, so we don't know whether, in fact, there are any costs at this point associated with any of these proposals. Assuming that this bill moves forward onto Representative Gladwin's committee, we will have time to fully vet that as well. Ms. Alfager.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Superintendent Jane Alfager, Education Minnesota, and I would like to commend Representative Brainerd for her work on all of the growth model work, and I am only testifying on page 13.17 related to section 7. And it was my understanding that we are not going to go forward with an engagement survey that is connected to the report card, student report card, school report card, excuse me. And so I am just putting it on the record that we would strongly oppose that. And I'm not exactly sure on line 13.34 when it references Minnesota Statutes 120B.35 sub 3, paragraph B, if indeed that eventually would go to the school report card. We think that collecting this data is fine. It's very valuable for a school district, and the school district can use the data in the manner in which they see fit to determine how to review it and then make decisions so that they can improve school climate and attitudes of kids, however they want to work with that. Our only exception is that we are concerned about using subjective data and putting it onto a report card where others will make judgments on those.
Thank you. Representative Brainerd, you get the last few seconds here.
Actually, both of these comments deserve further discussion, but I don't think we have time now, and I do think Dr. Norlin Weaver probably has some expertise to bring to the reliability, research-based, and objectivity of engagement measures. There's a 30-year history of research there that could be called on. But and on behalf of the bill, I just want to remind members that 18 months ago when the Joint Committee came together, our charge was to consider and recommend how to structure school performance to fully, fairly, and accurately report student achievement and emphasize school excellence under Minnesota's system of educational accountability and public reporting. I believe this bill makes considerable progress in that direction, and I hope you will support me.
Thank you. Representative Brainerd, we will certainly have another opportunity to discuss some of the lingering questions that have been raised here at the end of this hearing. Members, we're going to lay, what's the number? 1441. We're going to lay House File 1441 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. Members, we will meet again tomorrow at 8:30. It'll be a long day. We're going to, we do have the evening reserved. It's 6:30. Is that correct? 6:30 in the evening. We've got a number of bills to get through, hopefully we'll do that. We're going to have a busy week this week. So until tomorrow at 8:30, this committee stands adjourned. Yeah.